Well, good morning. This is Per Fagerheim, and the show is Fight the Empire. And our guest is Michael Hudson. Before I introduce him, I want to give an announcement here. This is for people who are interested in the labor struggle up in Longview, Washington. There is a solidarity night, and it is tonight in Longview at 5:30 p.m. at the Civic Circle in downtown Longview. Now, you can drive up there yourself if you want, or you can carpool. There are two carpools that I know of. One is at the AFSCME Union office, 6025 East Burnside. Got to be there by 4:30. That's 6025 East Burnside, no later than 4:30 p.m. And the other caravan is organized by Radical Women Freedom Socialist Party, and their number to call is 503-240-4462. And I will leave this information at the front desk later on. So now on to our guest, Michael Hudson. He is the business writer for iWatch News, and he was a writer for the Wall Street Journal, and he's the author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. Well, Michael Hudson, welcome back to KABU.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, we had you on back in last December, and we talked about your book, The Monster, and we let our listeners know that there is another Michael Hudson who is out there raising a ruckus, who is a professor of economics, I believe it's at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, but you are not him.
You, we are not each other. Michael and I get confused with each other quite often, and so we actually wrote a piece together recently, or actually a year ago, about the who we were and what we were doing, and it's interesting because we both focus on the same topics and many of the same problems.
But you are not confused about what Wall Street is doing to us, are you?
Maybe I'm scratching my head about it, but I have a pretty good sense of the kind of things that went on and the kind of abuses and fraud that really helped, you know, bring down our economy.
Why don't we start? Tell us what iWatch News is. I'm not familiar with that. This is fairly new, isn't it?
Right. It's iWatchNews.org. We're published by the Center for Public Integrity, which is one of the growing number of nonprofit online journalism organizations. As the legacy news media continues to struggle, as newspapers shut down and lay off people, a lot of the investigative energy is moving over to the internet, and it's not being done by for-profit organizations. It's being done by nonprofits that, you know, get their money from foundations, often the same funders who've been funding public radio for years are now funding us and some of the other nonprofit investigative journalism shops.
Well, I think this is really exciting because I hate to see, you know, I used to work for a newspaper in San Francisco, and I don't know, they seem to be shrinking all the time, literally. Our Oregonian here gets smaller and smaller all the time. When I was a kid in New York, I remember we had about 11 newspapers in New York City, and now there's, I don't know, three maybe? I don't know what there is. But anyway, so iWatch News is kind of filling this gap. I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, I refer to many of the newspapers around the country now as the unintentional nonprofit.
All right.
We're intentionally nonprofit. But there's a lot of exciting things going on. You know, there's a lot of problems in journalism, but I always tell people the solutions to the problems of journalism is more journalism, people going out and doing real reporting and fighting get the stories out.
So let's talk about you. You wrote a two-part series for iWatch News, sort of continuing the story of predatory lending, and this time you focus on Countrywide, which was later absorbed by the Bank of America, and you focus on a whistleblower, Eileen Foster. So should we start? Is that a good place to start?
Absolutely. Yeah, Eileen Foster was hired in 2007 to be Countrywide's head of Countrywide's fraud investigation team. You know, all big banks and big financial institutions had fraud investigators because they want to be able to tell their shareholders, they want to be able to tell regulators that, hey, we're on the case and we're taking care of it. But the real question is, how much backup do the fraud investigators get? And you know, it's interesting. You talk about sort of accountability, culpability of higher-level executives and a lot of the fraudulent practices that went on during the mortgage boom. And you know, nobody wrote an email and says, here's how we're going to take advantage of our customers. Here's how we're going to commit fraud. So really, the only ways to kind of tell, like, was fraud condoned is look at what happened when the gatekeepers, people like fraud investigators and underwriters, risk managers inside these companies, what happened when they raised red flags and said, hey, this particular loan is it appears that the income has been inflated, the appraisal is inaccurate, there seems to be fraud here, or more often, this entire pool of loans, or many of the loans in this pool of mortgages appear to be fraudulent. We need to stop this. We need to do something about it. Well, what happened with Eileen Foster and many of these other folks that I've talked to and I've also read their testimony is a number of things happened to them. Instead of being rewarded and promoted for doing their jobs, they were ignored, marginalized, harassed, demoted, or fired, or some combination of the above. And so that's what happened with Eileen Foster. She started doing some pretty aggressive investigations. She had her investigators say, for instance, pulling documents out of the shred bins at Countrywide offices around Boston, and they found evidence that the branch employees were using scissors and tape and whiteout to create fake bank statements and inflated property appraisals. For instance, they would find a cut-and-paste mock-up that indicated that someone had, as a matter of routine, literally cut and pasted the address from one home onto the appraisal for a completely different piece of property, and presto, basically inflating the value of the first home. The other thing they found out is that in some of these offices, they had more than one fax machine. And during interviews with the investigators, the workers admitted that the extra fax machine was used to simulate the fake documents being sent in by borrowers. And in order to eliminate the paper trail, they had the sending fax programmed so there was no banner identifying where the fax number was, it was coming from, or what time it was transmitted. So she found all this kind of stuff, and, you know, she thought she was doing a good thing by uncovering this and trying to stamp this out. But pretty quickly, she started getting pushback, she says. For instance, getting a call from a high executive who says, you know, in very more colorful language than I'm going to use, but saying, I'm sick and tired of these witch hunts. And eventually, she claims, instead of investigating the really endemic problem she was finding, the company began investigating her, and soon after the Bank of America takeover, Bank of America fired her, saying that there were problems with her management style, et cetera. Just within the last few weeks, the U.S. Department of Labor has concluded that Bank of America fired her not for legitimate reasons, but as payback for finding fraud. And has ordered her to get her job back, and that the bank pay her something like $900,000.
Has she got her job back yet? Because I think she was undecided about whether she wanted to go back to work for them.
Right. Well, I mean, the bank has 30 days to appeal the decision, so they're kind of in this netherworld right now as to what's going to happen next. You know, and so I spent a lot of time talking, even before the decision. I spent months and months talking to Eileen Foster about what she'd seen and the problems she saw. And in addition, I went out and tried to track down other former employees who had seen things. So basically, I found either in court records or in interviews, I found 30 former employees who you know, asserted that countrywide executives were encouraging or condoning fraud. And of those, and we're not talking about minor stuff, we're talking about falsified income documentation, inflated appraisals, and other stuff that really helps steer borrowers into to bad mortgages. And of those 30, 18 of them, including Foster, claimed that they were demoted or fired for questioning fraud. So this is a really important issue, is how internal whistleblowers are treated. And my reporting has shown me that one of the reasons why we didn't find out about all this corruption in the mortgage industry and Wall Street during the mortgage boom was that folks who tried to do the right thing, folks who tried to blow the whistle on fraud, were in one way or another silent.
Well, in your article, you say 30 former employees said that Countrywide condoned or encouraged fraud. And out of that 30, 18 were demoted or fired.
And they claim that it was not because of a layoff or something. They claim these 18 claim that it was because they were either questioning fraud or refusing to commit fraud, being ordered to commit fraud and refusing to do so.
Well, another person you brought up was a woman named Enid Thompson, who actually warned the Countrywide founder and CEO, Angelo Mozzillo. She gave him a warning. What happened to her?
Right. She said in a lawsuit that she emailed Mozzillo back in March 2007 and said that greedy, unethical people, quote-unquote, were pressuring employees to approve loans without any regard to the borrower's ability to repay. And she claims that within 12 hours of sending that email, that Countrywide executives, not Mozzillo specifically, it's unclear as to whether or not Mozzillo actually ever read that email, because I was told that people often, with other executives within the company, often screened his emails and read his emails for him. But within 12 hours, she claimed, Countrywide executives had began this campaign of reprisal against her. They reduced her duties. They started transferring staffers off her team. And also, she claims they literally sent people in to ransack her desk, leaving her papers strewn all over the place. They broke her computer,
oh, wow,
and removed her printer and personal belongings, and soon after was fired.
Now, did Mozzillo, you quote an email, I guess from Mozzillo, in which he said, track the bastard down and fire him. Does that really happen?
Well, what Eileen Foster said was that in her experience, Mozzillo encouraged people within the company to stop fraud. So, for instance, if he was in on an email, string, mm-hmm, that mentioned someone committing fraud in some far-flung branch, he would literally hit reply all and say, track the bastard down and fire him. But as Eileen Foster said, he often didn't see all this, and she felt like that people at a lower level or people underneath him basically kept things from him and acted, insulated him between what was going on. Now, there are other emails that Mozzillo sent where he says pretty strongly that some of the products that they were, foisting on the public were poison, were the most dangerous things he'd ever seen. And so he did express some concerns within the company, but the evidence is, there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that he did anything as the CEO to put the brakes on and say, hey, we got to quit selling people these products. We've got to change our practices. So there seems to be some evidence that he didn't know everything, but there's also seems to be evidence that he did have a sense that there was some bad stuff going on,
mm-hmm,
and that he really didn't do anything to stop it. The machine, the Countrywide mortgage machine, continued on and continued really cranking out a lot of bad loans and using lots of according to ex-employees and also according to a lot of lawsuits by state attorneys general, using lots of bait and switch salesmanship and other kinds of tricks to put people in loans they really couldn't afford. And now we're basically Bank of America, which bought the company, is sort of dealing with the consequences of this legacy, and they're really in this quagmire of legal and financial problems.
Yes, this is Fight the Empire, and our guest is Michael Hudson, who is a business writer for iWatch News, and he's the author of a book called The Monster and two recent articles for iWatch News about whistleblowing at Countrywide Finance. Let's get a kind of an overview here. I mean, Countrywide was really kind of trying to gobble up the mortgage market.
Right. They, you know, Countrywide, it's interesting because initially, at least back in the 1990s, Countrywide was not that interested in doing like subprime loans and the other kind of high-risk loans that eventually helped bring the mortgage market down. But Mozilla really wanted to be the biggest and never wanted to be number two to anybody. So they were pushing to be number one. By 2005, they were the biggest mortgage lender. They had the biggest market share. But he was saying, we want to keep going. We want to double or more than double our market share. We want to have 30% of the mortgage market by 2008. So there was a lot of pressure to really crank out as many loans as possible. And one of the things that Countrywide did was they had a policy which they would match any sort of loan program. If, you know, another lender, one of their competitors, had a loan which allowed people not to state their income, not to state their assets, and, you know, no down payment, no, you know, all that kind of stuff, 100% of the value of their house, all that kind of stuff, Countrywide would automatically match that, which, of course, would lower standards at Countrywide, but it also would have a ripple effect because if you had one lender that was doing that and then Countrywide, which was the industry leader, did it, then other lenders would pick up on it. So Countrywide, in some ways, in addition to making a lot of bad loans themselves, acted as this sort of, you know, conduit for bad practices and helped them spread to other companies.
Kind of like a race to the bottom.
Absolutely.
Or the bottom feeders or whatever. So the result is that Countrywide had a lot of mortgages or loans that would not be repaid.
And that's true.
And then when they kind of got into trouble, then the Bank of America was able to buy Countrywide at a kind of really what we call it a fire sale price. So
right,
tell
going out of business sale price, right?
Do you think Bank of America knew what they were getting into, or what was happening there?
Well, Bank of America says they did. They says that in the purchase price, they had factored in the idea that they were going to have to pay out a bunch of big, you know, they were going to have to pay out settlements based on some of the problem loans that Countrywide had been making. Many analysts will tell you that Bank of America didn't really know what they were getting into, or if they did, they made a very bad decision moving forward. I've asked Bank of America repeatedly to explain to me in detail what did they do to vet Countrywide, what did they do to see what the level of fraud, what the level of problems were there, both before the decision to buy the company and after the purchase was completed. What did they do? And Bank of America has just really not answered that question. They've said things like they took appropriate steps, but I can't really get from them the step-by-step what they did and the kind of investigation they made before making this huge purchase.
Well, now, Countrywide, when they made these bad loans, they didn't hang on to them. They sold them to Wall Street bankers and investors who now, I guess, are sitting on them. Or has the government bought up some of these loans to help the bankers out? What happened there?
Well, the government has bailed out some of the banks. I mean, there are a lot of investors that are hurt. I mean, literally, these loans would be packaged up into mortgage-backed securities, which would be sold all around the world. So you literally have village councils in Australia or New Zealand that bought these as investments. They thought it was a good way to invest the village treasury and got hit. You've got pension funds all over the country, all over the world, who bought these things. So really what the idea behind sort of securitization and packaging these loans into mortgage-backed securities pools was that you were going to spread the risk out really far, and so if some borrowers went into default, no big deal because everyone has lots of people around the world are exposed to the risk, but the problem was what it eventually did was it exposed the damage all around the world, and the damage was very serious, and really helped bring down the U.S. economy and cause a global financial crisis that's still playing out.
Has some of that jumped across to Europe? Is that part of the reason why Europe is in such trouble now?
Certainly part of it. I mean, Europe had their own banking problem.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely there were banks and other investment firms in Europe that bought some of the basically America's toxic mortgage waste.
But you had similar things happening in Ireland and Iceland and other places,
right,
too. Sort of inflated mortgages. And so trying to get a handle on this. So now one of the things is that, you know, like when these mortgages are put in a package, like say the mortgage on my house, which is paid off now, thank God, but say the mortgage on my house is sort of bundled in with maybe 1,000 others, and then they're so supposedly sliced and diced. How does that happen?
Well, basically, as an investor, you wouldn't own a specific mortgage. You would own, you know, you put a thousand, often more, you put 1,000 mortgages into a pool, and then you sell bonds, sell investments, you know, investments based on the income stream coming in from the monthly payments that the borrowers are making on the mortgages in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically you get a piece of the pool. You're not getting a specific loan, but you're getting you're basically getting the aggregate effect of whether or not the loan, the 1,000 loans in the pool or however many, are to do well or do poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the problem is instead of doing well, lots of these pools of loans did very poorly. And you would have default rates, serious default rates of 25% or more in a lot of these pools. And the whole system just kind of came crashing down.
Well, and now there's problems when banks, not just Bank of America, but when they try and foreclose on a home, and they really can't show that they own that. Is that still a problem?
That's definitely a problem. You know, you go back a couple generations, and this is the way the mortgage system worked. You would walk into a local bank, your local bank or local SNL, go to a corner office with the local, you know, the loan officer who was like a local VP, local vice president of
mm-hmm.
that branch, and that loan officer, his job was to generally say no as often as he said yes, to really determine can and will this loan be repaid. And there were problems with that system. There was discrimination against minority borrowers. There was discrimination against single women, et cetera, et cetera. But the basic idea that you should really, before you make the loan, you should determine what are the chances it's going to repay, is pretty sound. So you and then after you get the loan, you would literally, instead of mailing it in, you would probably just stop by the bank every month after you got your paycheck and write a check or pay in cash to cover your mortgage. Flash forward to 2004, 2005, and a loan officer was a 23-year-old kid who, 3 months before, he'd been working at Radio Shack. He's brought in and said, you make 100 phone calls, sit down and make 100 phone calls without getting up from your desk, call as many people as you can, and get as many people as possible to agree to let you pull their credit and start a loan application. And if you can't hack it, you're out the door. If you can hack it, you're going to make big money. So you would have these kids who would be making $10,000 in their first month, and it's like it was more money than they'd ever seen in their life. And their manager often had people tell me, you know, the manager would sort of urge and almost order them to go out and buy the most expensive car they could get.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be locked into the car payments and locked into the lifestyle. And then the next month they got to come back and sell more loans, and they got to make so they can make $12,000, and on and on and on. And basically the other part of the system was that. This loan would be made by one lender and then sold up the line to a bigger lender and then sold up the line to a bigger bank and then passed on to an investment bank, which would then put it into a pool of loans called a special investment vehicle, which was the same kind of accounting vehicle that Enron used to hide its financial shenanigans. And then it would be sold off all around the world. And so it was very easy for when the borrower said, hey, wait a minute, I was defrauded. You lied to me about what my interest rate was. You forged my signatures on some of the key disclosure documents. It was very easy for everyone in the line, up the line, to say, whoa, that wasn't me. That was done by somebody else, and just, you know, kind of point the finger down the line. And then, of course, the loan officer or the mortgage broker who did the actual hands-on fraud, he or she is gone. They've moved to another state. They've moved to another company. They're a mortgage brokerage. They've shut down, and they've opened up under a different name. And there was no accountability. So part of the idea was setting up these layers of insulation. But, of course, the thing that has kind of come back to bite the mortgage industry is by doing so, they created this really convoluted system. And you know, with the loans being passed, you know, back and forth like, you know, I don't know, Monopoly money or whatever, it's really hard to trace the chain of title and keep the documents straight.
So now,
in order to foreclose, they have to go back to some of the practices that we saw at the front end of the system, which is falsifying information on official documents, and in some cases forging signatures, and it's very much a mess.
And our state attorney general is really going after this. I've heard sort of get mixed news about that.
Well, some are and some aren't, but mm-hmm. as with before the mortgage meltdown, there are definitely a cadre of state attorneys general in a few states, such as New York, that have been much more aggressive than the federal government in terms of dealing with this problem. Most of the reporting I've seen on this, and I haven't done a lot of reporting specifically on the inside politics of this, but most of the reporting I've seen on this indicates that the federal government would like to settle for a lesser sum, or like to basically get a settlement done and you know, get it over with the big banks that are servicing these mortgages. But there's some holdouts, such as the Attorney General of New York, mm-hmm. who are saying, no, we need to have a tougher settlement. We need to get more money. We need to have more assurances that these practices are going to be fixed going forward.
Well, you don't want the taxpayers stuck with it either. But anyway, and then I understand that Eileen Foster is now working for a credit union.
She is indeed, right. After, one of the things about being a whistleblower is it really puts yourself in a difficult situation. You not only lose your job, but you may be blackballed within your industry. So she told me that she applied for 145 jobs before she got one.
Mm.
Now she works at a credit union in Southern California. She says it's a great job. She has a great boss. She's a straight shooter and, you know, very, very good place to work. But, you know, she's making about half what she was making at Bank of America
Unions. I've been in one for about 30 years now. It's great. But we have to end. We've been talking with Michael Hudson about the big mortgage scams. And thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for helping help me get the word out.
We will keep on doing that. Thank you again. And this has been Fight the Empire. Stay tuned for Aircast Skadia.